Institute. So I'm assuming, since this is a colloquium, that not everyone here studies cosmology as part of their day-to-day research. Maybe I should check. So how many people don't? It's a good assumption. Okay, great. So I don't need to vote. Great. And so I'd like to especially, and my style of giving a talk is I love it when you stop me with questions, and I will promise to end essentially on time. I'll do the bookkeeping of how I deal with that timing, but it's really much more fun for me if there's a lot of questions. So please interrupt, and we'll work that way. This topic for me starts with a number of sort of threads in my experience, and one of the really exciting things about doing cosmology these days, as opposed to 1983 when I did my thesis, is that there's so much data to work with. There's a huge amount of data, and you really need to pay attention to the data when you think about your theories. And so one very important data this is a talk about my sort of attempts to come to grips with different roles of infinity, and especially something called eternal inflation in cosmology. And one of the very influential pieces of data for me is actually shown in this photograph. So I don't know how many people here actually, I imagine most people here don't know the story behind this photograph. But I won't get into it here. I can tell you what I know later, and it's a really nice story. So I'm going to be here through the end of July, so you can get the story. But this is the Hubble Space Telescope through the window. This is the space shuttle. And this is the space shuttle actually on the Hubble, the most recent Hubble servicing mission. And the basketball is a basketball used by Edwin Hubble when he was an undergraduate at the University of Chicago and captain of the basketball team, where he led them to great successes. And if you look hard enough, you notice it's actually not the same ball, but it is actually, well, it's from the same year. And it definitely was also used by Hubble. And so I loved the story behind this picture. Yes. And so Rocky Kolb was behind this at the University of Chicago, and he told me the story, and I loved it. So he sent me the photo, and I sent back an email saying, "Well, I really love the photo. I love the story behind this photo, but I also, it makes me a little uncomfortable because it's clearly evidence against inflation." And of course, you don't mess with Rocky Kolb on these things. So he immediately sends an email back saying, "Don't worry, it's just evidence against eternal inflation." So the data's in. So now I have to think about theories that are not eternal inflation. So on a more serious note, one of the influences of this work has to do with going way back, again, starting in the 80s, there was a lot of different discussion of the what is the wave function of the universe. And people had different theories, and people argued and insulted each other. And my dear friend Neil here has been at the butt of some of these horrible insults from our mutual friend Andre Linde. I was aware of it. But somehow to me, it bothered me that it was just up to humans to think up the wave function of the universe. It didn't seem like the right way of doing things, especially the way people were going after each other about it. And so it occurred to me that an alternative to that is if you have a theory of the universe that is based on an equilibrium state. So if you think of the universe fundamentally in equilibrium, then there actually is no question about initial conditions, because equilibrium is equilibrium, and it cycles through states of equilibrium, and there's no separate question of initial conditions. And if you want to know the probability of finding the system in a particular state, well, you have your Boltzmann factor. E, we'll call it. It's given by the Hamiltonian of the system. And so it's if you know the laws of physics, you know the probabilities for a state. So it's a very different kind of idea than just talking, than declaring, you know, the wave function of the universe. So that was very appealing to me for a long time. But in the 80s, there was no good way to think about the universe as we knew it as an equilibrium system. And so that kind of sort of that idea kind of parked by the wayside for a while. But then with the discovery of cosmic acceleration, people started taking seriously the possibility that the universe had a fundamental cosmological constant. And it turns out, and I will argue that later in this talk, turns out that may give you some hint of how the universe can be in equilibrium. So that's another influence or bit of background for this talk. So cosmic inflation, and I'll introduce what this is in a minute, but cosmic inflation is widely regarded for its great phenomenology, and I'll show you what I mean by that. It lets you calculate things to compare with beta. It does that really, really well. But when inflation was first developed, it was actually, everyone thought it was an explanation of why the state of the universe we see today is more likely than other states. And that original goal, has been much more problematic. I don't think that's in very good shape at all. And that's actually the topic of this talk. So I'm going to be talking about efforts to understand, to pursue the original goal of inflation and understand why the universe as we find it is more likely than other possible states. But while I'm going on about this, and that is the topic of this talk, I encourage you, and I try to keep a side of myself engaged with this kind of skeptical question. Maybe this is too big a question. Maybe this is just too big a question, and maybe we should be happy that we have some phenomenology to work with. And it wouldn't be the first time in science if an idea was developed thinking you were doing one thing, and then it delivered something else instead. So I think people should ask, are we in a position to really address this very challenging question? Clearly, I think it's worth at least talking about it for an hour. but I encourage you to be skeptical. The outline of this talk is, first I do some really basic introduction. For those of you who are not so familiar with cosmology, I think that will be helpful. For those of you who are familiar, it will help you help you see how I'm going to present things, and it will help set things up for what happens next. I'll talk about eternal inflation, which is the most popular set of ideas to try and achieve this original goal of using inflation to explain why everything we see is the likely situation. It's problematic, but this is the most popular idea. Then I will introduce my own de Sitter equilibrium cosmology, which is exploiting the equilibrium idea to develop cosmology. And then at the end, I will give you a really new result, where I've actually made a prediction from the de Sitter equilibrium cosmology relating to observable levels of curvature in the universe. So that's the outline. Get started. So people who do cosmology use this equation every day. This is the represents the scale of the universe. This represents the rate of change, the cosmic expansion of the universe. And it's related. This is Einstein's equations in the highly symmetric metric that corresponds to roughly to the universe we see. And so on the right-hand side, we have all the different densities, the density of relativistic matter, the density of non-relativistic matter, the dark energy, whatever it is that's driving the cosmic expansion. And there's also curvature in here, and you can put it in different ways. I've put it in as another density like that. Each of these different densities have their own dependence on the scale factor. Curvature goes as a to the minus 2, radiation is a to the minus 4, matter is a to the minus 3. And for the dark energy, it's roughly a to the 0. And in fact, for this, well, later on, we'll focus in on the case where that's actually exactly a to the 0. So in standard cosmology, so this is just standard cosmology, we have some relativistic matter, some non-relativistic matter, relativistic in red, non-relativistic in blue. And so this is a picture, and now I've gone ahead and taken the dark energy to be a lambda, so it's absolutely constant here. So we have these three different behaviors, and this is the standard Big Bang. This is how we know the standard picture of the universe. And let's zoom in a little bit. So there's an era where the radiation dominates, but that doesn't last forever because the radiation goes down faster. There's an era where matter dominates. That transition happens about a few thousand factors of scale factors in the past. And then there's a time, and today, this is today, where the A naught, the naught subscript or superscript or whatever corresponds to the value today. It's a convention in cosmology. So today we're in a condition where the dark energy, in this case lambda, dominates by a reasonable factor. And then the next best thing is the matter. And then if you dig into it, it turns out the matter is mostly dark matter, stuff we've probably not detected directly at this point. But somewhere in there is the stuff we're actually made of. So this is a really standard picture of cosmology. Now, those of you who know me and my ways of discussing inflation know I'm actually I try to be very careful. The normal way to teach people about inflation is to say, there's all these cosmological problems and inflation solves them. I try to be more disciplined and say there are features in cosmology and then this is what you have to believe to think they're problems. And so I'm not going to get into that in this talk, but that shows up here because I'm going to talk about the curvature of the universe, and it's either a feature or a problem depending on how you think. And here's the main point, that if you start out with a whole bunch of curvature in the universe, it totally dominates today because its slope is more shallow on the spot. And we don't see any curvature today, so we've got to the extent there's some kind of equipartition early on, then you notice that the prediction is wrong, and so you've got to reduce it. But even if you reduce, notice this is a log scale, and we've reduced it by orders of magnitude, but there's still a lot. And you basically have to go way down, and then you wonder, well, why did I limit myself to have so little curvature at the beginning? You could also just say, well, we have one universe. And we've measured its curvature, and that's the truth about the universe. And so I'll leave you with, try to agitate a little bit about this feature/problem thing, but just leave you with that thought, and then point out in a minute what inflation does. So the another thing that actually, in certain theories of particles, is much more serious and concrete than the curvature problem is the monopole problem, where you actually can predict that at early stages of the universe, you produce a lot of relativistic matter of one sort or another. In the classic work, it was magnetic monopoles. And when you get those, of course, they come to dominate over the radiation by orders of magnitude today if you produce them early on. And so you worry about that. So we've got this Friedman equation, and what inflation does is propose an additional contribution called the inflaton that also evolves as A to the approximately zero. And here's what it can do for you. Well, here's how you typically get it. You assume a homogeneous scalar field. It obeys an equation like this. This is just a standard equation for a scalar field. It's coupled to other matter via the Hubble parameter, which is A dot over A from the previous slides. And this gives a damping term. I've also put in the coupling to ordinary matter, which is very important for inflation, and there's some kind of potential. And it turns out basically all potentials have a slow roll or overdamped regime where this damping term dominates and the density and the inflation is roughly constant roughly goes to z to the zero. And this can happen in many cases at a local maximum of a potential or when the potential gets very large. And that's coming later. So I have a little more math to go with that a little bit later. So, and here's what inflation can do for you. You propose that this inflaton actually dominated the universe at early times. There it is going as a to the zero. And in this plots I show you, I've actually solved that equation with particular couplings to matter. So it actually couples to matter. This is an actual solution to those equations. It couples to radiation and produces the radiation era as needed for standard cosmology. So if you add a period of inflation, then even if you started out with a lot of curvature, the inflation kind of gives you this, kicks things out a little bit and lets you avoid having curvature at late times. And the same thing with monopoles. So inflation is a way to kind of avoid some of these other components. And here's a little detail, just since I told you, if you go to the trouble to solve equations, you want to show it off. So here's the inflaton. It's actually rolling in a just a simple quadratic potential. And we have a time where the potential energy dominates. The kinetic energy, the phi dot, is very small in comparison. It's slowly rolling down the potential. It reaches a point, and the radiation is very subdominant, but you're feeding a little bit into radiation as you go. And then eventually, the kinetic and potential terms become comparable, and the field starts oscillating the potential. And along the way, it produces more radiation, which finally ends up dominating. And here you see the field is slowly rolling. This is the field value, slowly rolling and then oscillating in the bottom of the potential, which looks like that. So this is one example of how inflation can work. Any questions so far? It's kind of an introduction to cosmology and inflation. And I guess I'd say that, you know, the idea that inflation can explain what we see is partly related to the idea that you think, certainly based in this simple picture, you think you can throw all kinds of junk in at the beginning, and inflation gets rid of them and then creates radiation in a controlled way that can actually lead to a cosmology that works well and fits the data. And so that's the way people feel good about inflation. Now I want to, for the rest of the talk, I'd rather talk about length scales than densities. And it turns out there's a nice, simple connection between them. The Hubble length is this thing. You can think of it basically, oh, and by the way, I apologize. A lot of people, this is really rho critical for cosmology experts, and rho total might be something else because the curvature is in here. But this is just the sum of all these terms that appear in the Friedmann equation. The Hubble length, you can think of as the distance light travels in one E-folding of expansion. It's just, you know, the expansion is a expansion rate, A dot over A is a 1 over time. You use C to turn that into a length. And I want to show you about the Hubble length here. So this is still a density plot. But in addition to the different pieces that I've shown before, I've put the total in. So I've just summed them all up on the yellow curve. And then I've extracted just the total here. And now I've changed the scale. I'm warming up for something. Changed the scale a little bit, same curve, different axes. Put in the zero line here. And then I notice that the Hubble length is related to 1 over the density. So I'm going to 1 over means I'm going to flip it in this logarithmic plot. There it is. I haven't taken the square root yet. It's still squared. And then the square root does its thing. And so then, of course, as everyone does with plots, you change the axes so it fills the plot. But basically, if you're less used to, so I'm going to be plotting these kind of plots for the rest of the talk. And if you feel a little bit on unfamiliar territory, don't forget, it's really just the density plot flipped over and rescaled, the density plot that I've been showing you before. So maybe that'll help you feel a little bit more connected to it as we go. So whereas the universe starts at high density and goes down to low density, it starts at low Hubble length and goes up to high Hubble length. And just to remind you, all the different ingredients are still there, playing their roles, dominating at different stages. So, and even there's the total. So that's the shtick about the Hubble length. So I like these plots. They show the entire history of the universe. And so I'm just going to take a minute to label this plot with all the different ingredients. So here's the time when the inflaton stopped having its slow roll behavior. Reheating is when the universe is really dominated by the relativistic matter that the inflaton couples into. So that happens a little bit later in this logarithmic time scale. We're using the scale factor, which tracks the expansion of the universe, as a time variable here. A little bit later, the temperature of the universe is around the electroweak scale of particle physics. A little bit later is the scale when nuclear processes underwent the formation of the light elements in cosmology, one of the very famous parts science of cosmology. A little bit later, we hit the radiation matter equality point, which I told you about before. And on this plot, unless you draw the eye to it, you might not notice there's a little kink, but the scaling actually changes at radiation matter equality. And then here we are today. So the entire history of the universe on one slide. Now I want to focus on something else. So I took the other decoration off. And there's something very cool about the theory of inflation, which allows you to relate the perturbation. So far I've been treating a homogeneous and isotropic universe. But the universe as we know it has deviations from homogeneity and isotropy. And those deviations in a cosmology that has a period of inflation can be related to so the perturbation, the variation in the density on the scale set by the Hubble length here is related to where this co-moving scale. So co-moving means it's just a scale that scales with the scale factor. So you take some physical length and just follow it as the universe expands, co-moving with the expansion. And so you take a scale you're interested in here and you follow its co-moving value and find when this curve crossed the Hubble curve, the Hubble length curve here, and then what's happening during inflation here essentially gives you the value of the perturbation at the other crossing point up here. And you can do this for any scale you want. So inflation gives you information, gives you something concrete to say about the perturbations on any scale of the universe. And so, for example, one thing we know is we know the rough amplitude of these perturbations. And then to get the amplitude right, we have to then adjust the parameter and the potential. In this case, there's only one parameter. We have to adjust that parameter to have a particular value to get the right amplitude for the perturbations. So it all hangs together. And then more excitingly, this can be applied to real data, and there's lots of it now. There's just amazing data. And so people go out and, for example, this is data. This is just CMB data on this plot. There's all kinds of data out there. This is you map the sky at radio wavelengths. You extract the piece of that radiation that's coming from the distant parts of the universe. And then you plot its power spectrum. In this case, we're looking at polarization, even more of a sophisticated way of looking at it. And all the data is from great experiments. And the curves are coming from the inflationary model. So they're coming. I did a sort of cartoon of this calculation. But there's lots of in-depth technical work that goes in to getting a curve of the sort I'm plotting here. And those are very and so that's pretty exciting. Whatever formal questions you have, it's pretty exciting to have a simple idea that leads to something you can really compare with data. Not only that, it can actually fit the data, which is there are actually, in the 90s, we worked on other theories that were ruled out by this kind of data. So it's not a trivial thing to fit this kind of data. There's theories that do and theories that don't, so it's very exciting to have a theory that does. These are certainly not trivial features to reproduce with a theory. Right. So I think you can ask a more sort of broad question: is does inflation get full credit for those features, or could they come about another way? And I'm not. So yes. And in fact, Neil certainly worked on models where for example, where you get those features a different way, and others have tried to do that. We could get into a little bit more of that, but not. I probably won't take time now for that. But we can talk about it. I think it's very important to be skeptical at that level. But I think some of the skepticism I've heard, not from Neil but from others, I think is too weak. It's not that good. But there is room for skepticism for sure, and it's important to think that way. But it's certainly, it's this kind of picture combined with a lack of skepticism that makes people very excited about inflation. But maybe more than they should be, even then. So that's where we're going. So here's more data came out this May. This is one of the plots. So it's certainly very exciting. But this is, anyway, so. Once we see the basic perturbations, this is just layers of plasma, layers of plasma physics. Yeah. Right. Yeah, I think. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So now I'm going to. So that's the basics. I'm done with the basics. Any more questions about basics? This is a good time. Next, I go to eternal inflation, and I sort of have a hierarchy of questions here. So, reminding you, sort of my big question was: does inflation make the standard Big Bang natural in some way? The standard Big Bang, by the way, is the cosmological picture after the end of inflation. So that's the that's the cosmological picture I learned in school. It's been successful. We you know, it's done very well as just a phenomenology of the universe, but we're trying to go beyond that and ask the question, for example, does halving inflation make the standard Big Bang natural in some way? And, well, I think it's clear that part of that question has to be, how easy is it to get inflation to start? So if you start saying, well, this is the likely direction for the universe to go, you have to argue that this inflationary period, which I just kind of threw in there at the beginning, actually is likely to start, or likely enough to start, to compete successfully against other ideas you might have. So that might be a question you want to ask. And then, just to make it a little easier, why don't we just start by asking, well, what did happen before inflation, which is sort of has to be at the bottom of, you know, what do you think happened before inflation? And I'm going to take a really simple-minded view of that and see where it takes us. So quantum fluctuations play a role during the rolling of the scalar field. And there's a whole way you can study that in terms of the behavior of the. So the field I've shown as this homogeneous, it looks like a single degree of freedom, but it's a quantum field is actually, or any field actually, is made of many, many degrees of freedom. And there's a standard way of thinking, right or wrong, about what's happening with these modes during inflation, which among other things, tells you that on any given on a scale of a coherence length, which is set by the Hubble length, the modes of the field are being expanded into up to that scale from smaller scales, and that at each Hubble time there's a new uncorrelated quantum contribution to the value of the field from a new mode that's shown up on that scale, like coherence length, and that leads to a sort of variation, a change in the value of phi as a function of time on a scale set by h squared. But this is actually a random process, random contributions to the evolution of the field. And so you can think of the quantum nature of the field being being controlled by the comparison between this quantum phi dot and the classical phi dot, and which is given by this expression, which is the same expression within some constant factors as the value of the perturbation I just gave you, which is, I already told you, has to be set around 10 to the minus 5 for a realistic cosmology. And so, therefore, you can conclude that the quantum is suppressed compared to the classical evolution as this field is rolling. It's suppressed, and 10 to the minus 5 is not a huge number, but it's actually pretty big compared to, if you ask about what's classical about my sunglasses or this glass of water, any everyday thing is much more classical than that. So having quantum things at the 10 to the minus 5 level is actually pretty quantum. But maybe, so for realistic perturbations, this is still quite classical. And so let's just extrapolate back. If you're asking what happened before inflation, we had some inflation going on here, well, maybe the right thing to do is extrapolate back and say, well, it was rolling a little further up. And to do that, I'm now going to show you what comes from that way of thinking back on my favorite kind of plot. So we go back to my favorite kind of plot. I've plotted all these important times in the universe. I've plotted a few. So this is the scale that comes in at the Hubble length value today. This is a co-moving scale that comes in at four orders of magnitude below that, which is sort of the scale where the universe is still linear enough that you actually can kind of notice what perturbations have come from the primordial state. So there we go, but now I'm going to zoom out. So remember, we're following this rolling scalar field back up the potential, and as we do so, we're getting more and more inflation. So I'm going to zoom out, and every time I zoom, the previous slide is going to appear as a blue box. And one of the things that happens as I roll up the potentials, I actually change the conditions of inflation. So the perturbations I'm producing on these earlier scales, which get mapped onto larger scales of the universe, are actually larger. So here's the perturbation value. Now it's gone up to an order of magnitude from before. Still kind of small. I'm just going to keep zooming. And as I zoom, notice the observable universe is shrinking down into this little region there. I've lost the resolution. I can't even tell the difference between these two curves I had here. And now I've got a perturbation of even larger amplitude. And I keep going, even larger amplitude perturbations. And I keep going, they just get larger and larger. And finally, I have delta rho over rho equals 1 on this very large scale. And then I remind you that that corresponds to the quantum versus classical comparison. So all of a sudden, the rolling has become, or not all of a sudden, very gradually, but we've followed it all the way up to where the rolling becomes very quantum. So it's not at all classical evolution at this point. So this is called the self-reproduction regime, and there's a substantial probability of fluctuating up the potential and continuing the inflationary expansion as it is to roll down. So once you're rolling classically down the potential, your destiny is to hit the reheating regime, hit the region where the slow roll potential dominated behavior stops being the physical description, and you reheat and produce Big Bang cosmology. So all along here, even though we were telling this very interesting story, the destiny, which is a basically classical solution with the destiny to become the Big Bang cosmology. Once we hit here, it's not so clear because there's some probability for the field to go up. Note that the observable universe is tucked away just way, you know, in one pixel or something on this screen. And another thing to point out is that the scales that become the universe today are 10 to the minus several tens of thousands of the Planck length when this is starting. So it's a very, you're embracing these huge scales in the universe and tiny scales in the universe. Whereas today, so if we talk about the scales that affect the universe today, they're around the Planck length. So it's still something to think about, but not as extreme as for this grand extrapolation we've done back. And as you're going to see, I find, when I made these slides, even though I'm used to thinking about this stuff all the time, when I made these slides, I found it really interesting and a bit amazing. It's already a truly grand extrapolation you're doing, and that's not even the problematic extrapolation. That's just the warm-up. That's just kind of getting you to the exciting part. It's already a pretty big extrapolation. So the substantial probability of sort of fluctuating up the potential leads to something called eternal inflation. And the idea is basically that on this picture now, when we're way up here, the quantum fluctuations compete successfully with the classical rolling. And I'm not going to talk technical talk about the slide, except to say that really every potential has the capacity to have a self-reproduction regime. So if you, I mean, my impression is no one's found a model, a potential for an inflaton that doesn't have that. And I don't know, Neil, do you know of any counterexample of that? You know, steeper's good. Steeper. I mean, steep enough not to have slow roll, so I can bend it enough, then I break the slow roll. Okay, well that's okay. So maybe that's a way. But right. So it's tricky for sure not to have self-reproduction, and certainly most of the models people propose for inflation have it. So people have done lots of attempts to visualize eternal inflation, and I find them all pretty daunting and hard to. There's this one, which I never quite understood what it meant. There's another one that looks like a giant bong, which I also never quite. I mean, afterwards, if you think you know what that one means, you should tell me because I don't. So now I've tried. So now I'm going to, after insulting other efforts to describe it, I'm going to make my own attempt, and you can tell me whenever you like. What you thought of that, but it is hard. It's a hard. I think it's a pretty amazing thing. It's hard to visualize. So here's my attempt. So we have this self-reproduction regime where there's quantum fluctuations playing a big role in the evolution of the scalar field, and I basically say consider a patch of self-reproduction regime, which I've marked with this hashed space, and I'm measuring at this point. Units and units of the Hubble length at the time, so I'm taking a patch that's several Hubble lengths across. But then I want to consider the case where one coherence length worth of stuff actually starts rolling classically away from the self-reproduction regime, and that's I've shown in blue at time equals zero. So some patch starts rolling classically. So a Hubble time later, the I'm following now. So what I'm doing is following the expansion here. So one Hubble time later, I'm increasing the size accordingly. The universe has expanded by a factor of 2, by e to the 2, and I've increased the size. I followed. This is exponentially expanding. This is expanding. So I've increased the size. And the way you see that all that scaling has gone on, and by the way, these are pocket universes. The word people use is pocket universe. Part that starts rolling classically down. The new thing that, again, still the coherence length is just the Hubble length. The new thing that starts rolling in these new rescaled pictures is smaller because it's the same physical size, but I rescaled everything to follow the exponential expansion of the cosmos. And then three Hubble times later, the poor new guy is just disappearing because I'm busy rescaling to track the original one. And so that's sort of the beginning. As I'm following this, the universe is, during inflation, the universe expands exponentially in time. So as a function of time, which is what I'm showing, everything's expanding exponentially with the Hubble parameter setting the scale, the Hubble length, or Hubble length over c setting the time. And the next interesting thing that happens, so basically that's what I have at this level is some classical rolling patch, a new classically rolling patch is starting all the time, but on scales, because this has continued to inflate, the new patches that start rolling are, relatively speaking, smaller. But then something interesting happens. As the inflaton rolls down the scalar field, its rate of expansion is slowly decreasing. The rate of expansion is proportional to the density, square root of the density. And so as the energy density goes down in the scalar field, the rate decreases, and eventually the classically rolling path separates from the background expansion, the self-reproduction regime, and starts. So if I keep following, so here we are at 500 Hubble times, I keep rescaling by the 500 Hubble times, even this original classically rolling patch starts looking small by comparison. And of course, the new regions, the new pocket universes are down at some tiny scale, at some, in one pixel or something. So, and the poor thing just disappears as it loses its oomph with the exponential expansion. But then I can always rescale, right? So what I'm going to do next, watch this factor. It's going to go down. I go back and follow this guy a little bit more. So we can follow. I'm just, by definition, this thing is staying constant because that's what I'm following. Notice now that the number here is no longer matched to the number here because the universe is actually expanding faster than the classically rolling. And of course, this poor thing is just pining now. But now something else happens. Else interesting happens is that the classically rolling thing stops expanding exponentially at all. It reheats, and then it doesn't compete. It's not competing at all, and so it just sort of disappears. And so we have this region that's just expanding exponentially, gives birth to these little pocket universes. They do their thing, but there seems to be no stopping this self-reproduction regime. There's always more of it, because there's always some of the scalar field that's fluctuating up the potential. So here's now, so that's the picture. You can like it or dislike it, along with the other pictures of eternal inflation. But let me just now list the features of eternal inflation. In eternal inflation, most of the universe, at least most of the universe that started with this patch, is always inflating. It leads to an infinite universe, because it never stops. It leads to infinitely many pocket universes, and the self-reproduction phase lasts forever, although I should say globally lasts forever, because any given region will eventually roll down. It's just that you're producing volume in the self-reproduction regime, and so you get more. Every bit you lose, you get a lot more. Inflation seems to take over the universe. So in that sense, it seems like a good theory of initial conditions. So the thinking, the proponents of eternal inflation say, I don't know how hard it might be to start inflation, but once it starts, you create this infinite volume that takes over the universe. So maybe I don't have to worry about how it starts. And that's an appealing line of thinking in some communities. I'm not so sure about it, but I'm trying to sort of present this other point of view. Now the trouble starts. So you have infinitely many pocket universes because you just never stop inflating. And so to make predictions about what, so you can have pocket universes with different kinds of behavior, and you want to make a prediction which one is more likely. And to do that, you need some kind of regulator because there's an infinity here. And if there's two different kinds of pocket universe and infinitely many of each one, that you can't get an answer of which is more likely. So you need to do a regulator. And you typically use some kind of time cutoff. So you cut it off at some finite time and then let the cutoff go to infinity. That's a standard kind of regulator. And for typical time cutoffs of a variety of sort, the most recently produced pocket universes are exponentially favored because they're produced, you've waited longer for the self-reproduction, the region. There's just more stuff to see these universes from because he waited longer. So that leads to, so whenever you put in a cutoff, it doesn't matter that you then let the cutoff go to infinity. You've predicted that most of your universes are young. And there's lots of technical ways. I'm watching the clock, and I don't want to dwell. This leads to big problems that the experts do not think have been solved. That you can call it the young universe problem, the end of time problem, which is a rewording of this, as far as I can tell, and more generally, measure problems. And in fact, because the measure, people use the word measure for this cutoff, for this procedure for resolving, trying to make predictions in the face of the infinities. And in fact, the state of the art right now is that instead of making predictions, the experts are using the current data to infer the correct measure. So they're saying, well, this measure isn't working because it's not fitting the data, so let's find another one that does. And so all this celebratory business of saying we fit all the data so well is actually not happening. If you're trying to ask these deeper questions instead of just take inflation as a little part of the story to tack on the beginning of the universe, if you're trying to explain where this all came from, if you're trying to explain initial conditions in this way, you're actually not making predictions at all at this point. You're trying to reverse engineer data to help you understand how to use a measure, how to interpret the eternal inflation. One really interesting point to me is that the claims from people like Alan Guth, one of the serious proponents of this, is that the only way this idea of initial conditions works is if you really have a true infinity. So the eternal inflation really never ends, ever, not just at some big value. I find that really hard to swallow. And I almost, Alan Guth is going to be here, and I look forward to talking. I've had some actually really fun conversations with Alan over the last year, and I look forward to continuing them. But I can show you, we've had some fun with toy models, and you can see how, certainly in the toy model, you can see how that works, how you really need infinite time to make this work. Ever since I was a student, I always thought, for physicists, infinity should never really mean anything different from very large but finite. So I'm very skeptical of this idea. That's one of the reasons. I'm not talking about the string theory landscape. Those of you who've heard of the string theory landscape, I just say that there's lots of inflation going on in different lots of things causing inflation, whether it's a slow roll type or just other types, and you just end up with lots more of this eternal inflation. The string theory. So if it's hard to understand in one instance, it's even harder to understand in the string theory landscape. So I think that's a big problem. If you believe in eternal inflation and the string theory landscape, it's really difficult. You're in a really difficult position right now. There's actually some really interesting issues raised by Don Page in this eternal inflating multiverse that comes out. There's actually many copies of you. There's many copies of you doing measurements because there's infinitely many pocket universes. There's, take any finite data that describes you. There's going to be lots of things fitting that description out there in this infinite thing. And Don Page has showed that actually the Born rule of quantum mechanics isn't. You can't. The questions you want to answer in that context no longer are. Well-posed quantum mechanical questions. And I'm just going to leave it at that. Lots of people here think about quantum theory. That's a very interesting topic to get into, but I won't just leave that as a bookmark for later discussion. So this is the point where you might catch your breath and say, well, maybe you're just happy you have some equations to solve, to draw curves and fit this data. Maybe this is getting too hard. So think about that. So, because what happens when you try to calculate with eternal inflation is this. A problem has been detected, and your calculation has been shut down to prevent damage. Relative probability overflow. If this is the first time you have seen this stop error screen, restart your calculation. If this screen appears again, follow these steps. Check to make sure all extrapolations are justified and equations are valid. If you are new to this calculation, consult your theory manufacturer for any measure updates you might need. I've never actually read one of these screens until I prepared the slide, but this is meant to actually correspond roughly to the. If the problems continue, disable or remove features of the theory that cause the overflow error. Disable BS instead of BIOS, BS options such as self-reproduction or infinite time. If you need to use safe mode to remove or disable components, restart your computation and utilize here I go, so now I'm advocating my point of view, the entropy associated with lambda to select holographic options. So now we go on to the Sitter equilibrium cosmology. So here's what I do with the Sitter equilibrium cosmology. I take ideas that are floating around under the loose heading of holography related to cosmological constant lambda to construct a finite cosmology. I build on the initial motivation. So I mentioned my interest in equilibrium systems before, and that comes in here. And I like to give this shtick about the Bohr atom, because actually anyone's theory about inflation or the cosmos depends on ideas about the fundamental physics that we don't know to be true. We don't know how the fundamental physics really works. And so we our best hope. So in a bad mood, I can say, well, maybe we should just figure out the fundamental physics and then see how cosmology works. But most of the time, I'm in a better mood than that. And I think, well, there's something that seems to be working about inflation. So why don't we ask the question, what kind of fundamental physics would it take to make inflation actually work? And maybe that will give us some hints about how the fundamental physics needs to be. And that's in the spirit of the Bohr atom, where the Bohr atom is certainly not quantum physics, but it helped people start thinking the right way. So that's the optimistic point of view. I can't promise you it's right, but that's the optimistic point of view, and that's what I'm taking when I work on this project. And at the very least, it's a counterpoint to the infinities of the eternal inflation. And just to be clear, I unabashedly exploit uncertainties in the fundamental physics. So I'm going to consider a finite system, a finite Hilbert space. So no continuum field theory is absolutely correct, because continuum field theory requires an infinite Hilbert space to describe it. But I'm going to be very, very selective in how I assume the breakdown occurs, and do it with the interest of creating a realistic cosmology. And the time I have left, we won't get into too much of the nitty-gritty, but I will say that I've made assumptions. So I think eternal inflation is a pretty amazing and extravagant extrapolation. I've done extravagant things here, too. So if you want to quiz me, I can tell you all about it. But I'm curious. So this is just pursuing the question, is there a finite alternative that actually seems to work in some way? And there's papers. I've written some papers about it, so you can read more about it. So I go back to my favorite picture. I take off the decorations again. And now I'm going to focus in on late times. I focus in on late times. And I'm going to point out, of course, that at late times, I'm now assuming a true cosmological constant that dominates the universe at late times. And now I'm going to tell you something interesting about this behavior. It's called the Sitter space when lambda dominates cosmology. And now I consider something called the past horizon. So I consider an event late in the Sitter era. And I consider an event where I am observing a photon. And then I plot the distance. So I'm a co-moving observer. I'm not zooming around. I'm sitting with the cosmic expansion. And then I plot the distance. So this is, remember, a length axis. I'm plotting the distance the photon is from me at past times. So I just plot this here. And one of the interesting things is this is a photon propagating toward me, but nonetheless, the distance is increasing with time. And that's the way it works in cosmology. If I'm looking at a distance that's larger than the Hubble length, the separations of objects are increasing faster than the speed of light. And so the poor little photon is propagating toward me at the speed of light, but the universe is creating space between me and it. And that's what dominates until the Hubble length catches up with the distance of the photon and then eventually comes to me. So that's the past horizon. Then I can take another event, even deeper in the De Sitter era, and that has its own past horizon. And it's the same thing over here. And there's something very interesting happening. And this is the De Sitter space actually has an event horizon. So De Sitter space has an event horizon much like a black hole event horizon. And so all the photons that I see have come in, have hovered at this horizon, and then eventually come out to find me. And the upshot is that any event, no matter how deep into the De Sitter era, has the same past horizon back here. So you just hit up against the Sitter horizon, and then you and then that's the curve you get at earlier times. And by the way, if you're used to studying horizons in cosmology in a sort of classic way, there's another kind of horizon called the future horizon, and I just want to put that slide up and say it's totally different. So you've got to learn about the past horizon. It's totally different from the future horizon in cosmology. So now I want to talk a little bit about the implications of that consider horizon. So do I have about 5 minutes? Is that? Yeah, okay. So implications of the De Sitter horizon. So as with the black hole, this horizon has been associated with an entropy by Gibbons and Hawking. It's been shown to be the maximum entropy. So you take a De Sitter space and throw a black hole in. Even though the black hole adds entropy, it actually shrinks the horizon enough that the total entropy goes down. And then when the black hole decays, you achieve again the De Sitter entropy, which is truly maximal. It has a temperature, the Gibbons-Hawking temperature. So it's tempting to think, so here's this cartoon picture of a De Sitter space with a horizon. It's tempting to think of the De Sitter space as the ultimate equilibrium for the universe. So before we had observed cosmic acceleration, people weren't really thinking that maybe there was a fundamental cosmological constant, sort of subdominant, the physics we observed at the time. But in fact, now we think there might be. And so that leads us to think maybe the end point of the universe is this maximum entropy state with a finite entropy, finite temperature. And I'd say also equilibrium at its most sort of heuristic definition is just it's what happens to a system when you wait long enough. So that's certainly what we have here, certainly an equilibrium in that sense. So the implications, so we have an entropy, we have a temperature. One of the interesting implications is that only a finite volume is ever observed of the universe because this past horizon marks off what we actually see in the universe. If lambda is truly constant, we can then think of cosmology as this equilibrium De Sitter state fluctuating up into more cosmological solutions. And one important point that I exploit here is that a number of people have argued that if there's a maximum entropy, and if entropy is a logarithm of the number of states, then shouldn't you think of the system as having a truly finite Hilbert space? Why would you ever contemplate a Hilbert space larger than e to the maximum entropy if this is a truly finite system? And there's a lot of interesting ideas that go along with this point of view. And so for this De Sitter equilibrium cosmology in particular, I embrace these ideas fully and exploit them to get the picture that I want. So equilibrium. I think we all think about a box of gas when we think about equilibrium. And so here's what I'm thinking. Here's a cartoon of what I'm thinking. So a box of gas sits there. It can have a rare fluctuation. So in equilibrium, there's no arrow of time. Nothing interesting happens at all. But you can have a rare fluctuation. And actually, in this picture, there's a double-headed arrow of time. You start in the lowest entropy state and follow toward higher entropy. And that can go both ways. And so you have a rare fluctuation. With it comes a transient arrow of time that's double-headed in this way. And associated with this is the Boltzmann brain problem, which is very simply stated that if that's how you think about the universe, if we know this room exists in the universe, the prediction of this theory is just this room will fluctuate out of chaos and fluctuate back in. And if you say, okay, well, there's the whole building, even the new part, well, then the theory is that fluctuates out and goes in. So you have to, you don't get a big universe at all in this theory. And if you dial the scale back, maybe it's just your brain fluctuating out. So it's a problem. Theories like this are known to be problematic. Just put that out there, and I'll come back to that in a second. So the concept of this equilibrium state is realized in my picture with the De Sitter space, again, shown in this cartoon. The rare fluctuation is realized by a fluctuation in the De Sitter space produced from the Hawking radiation. And in particular, I discuss the process. So I assume there is an inflaton in the theory, and that there's a chance for that inflaton to fluctuate up the potential. And I study that process using the Guth-Farhi tunneling process to get the inflicon of the potential. And to do that, you need a seed forming from the Hawking radiation, and then that instanton can the Guth-Farhi instanton can let you tunnel to a state of inflation up the hill. The rate is actually well approximated by this ridiculously simple Boltzmann factor, which isn't really, has gravity. This isn't as simple-minded as it looks, but that's the answer. And the seed mass that you need for inflation set by the unification scale is of this order. So the seed mass, so basically anything, to produce anything heavier than a gram, you might as well produce a whole universe, the probability of producing a whole universe. So the idea that you can take a small fluctuation and make it inflate, which was the original intuition of what was so cool about inflation, is realized here that as long as your brain weighs more than a gram, you're more likely to produce it in the whole universe in this picture than just one. So I believe that when we understand it, and I don't think we're there yet, but when we understand it, inflation will be seen, the best thing inflation will be seen to do for you is actually save you from the Boltzmann brain problem, which so far has been, a serious problem in cosmology. Not enough time to advertise some of this other work. So the picture is basically you have this equilibrium state. It sits there. It tunnels off a baby universe. It goes through inflation, radiation, and matter. And the sitter, once it hits the sitter, it's in this finite system. It needs to just re-equilibrate with the original equilibrium. You can't produce infinite numbers of baby universes because at the end of the day, it's only a finite system at play. There's implications of the finite system is that there's recurrences. There's breakdowns of continuum field theory. And the last minute, I'm just going to show you what one implication is of that. This is, again, my favorite picture. This is the past horizon shown coming all the way back. And this is how much inflation you have to fill one past horizon, one distant horizon. And all this inflation is extra. And in fact, it fills more than one distant horizon. In fact, anything in this region, the observer will never see. So I view this as outside of. So in my view, this is an unreasonable extrapolation of the continuum field theory to regions that are the observer's never going to see. It's outside the distant horizon. So why even? I don't want that to be part of my theory. So I, in a rather ad hoc way, I'm afraid, just declare that to be where the continuum field theory breaks down. I'll save that technical point for later. And so here's the picture that the past horizon, which is universal for any event over here, determines the starting point of inflation. I declare in my theory that continuum field theory breaks down if it tries to produce more entropy than the finite entropy of one distant horizon. To do that, inflation has to start. These are different inflation models. This is low-scale inflation, high-scale inflation, long reheating, short reheating, all kinds of different models of inflation. What they have in common in my picture is they have to start on this past horizon line to keep them from producing more entropy than the finite system can possibly handle, can possibly describe. And so one of the interesting features, and I'll just end with that point, is that we start with this formation of the inflation, the tunneling, and it has some intrinsic curvature associated with it. The curvature, we can put curvature on this plot the same as everything else. It turns out curvature travels along in proportion to the scale factor, just as the past horizon does. So there's this unifying point of view where the curvature, the omega bubble, determines the relationship between the Hubble length at the start of inflation to the curvature length. So it gives us this initial gap. And then these two things just travel together till the current time in the universe. And it doesn't matter what's happening with the different inflation models, what's happening in your cosmology. This thing is behaving in a very simple way. And at the end of the day, it lets you, and you can read the paper or see me afterwards to see the technical details. It leads to a very a quantitative prediction that's actually very simple. that says, all you need to know is the matter density today, the value of the cosmological constant, which we'll know better and better with modern data, and then the initial value, the initial curvature of the bubble gives you the value predicted of curvature today. There's nothing else in the problem. No details of the inflation, no details of reheating, no details of the other cosmologies, just a prediction that depends on these two quantities, which we'll know very well, and the bubble, which we don't know well yet, but which we're studying and can learn more about. And so this is what's consistent with current data. Now I'm talking about real data, not pictures of basketballs in space. And this is, I find this tremendously exciting. So these are realistic values of the bubble curvature, and the they're just on the edge of current data. So if my theory's right, we should see curvature as the data gets better. And there's no question this data will get better. It will be very easily tightened up by an order of magnitude, and it should be possible to get down to the cosmic variance bound, which is about three orders of magnitude smaller. So this is highly speculative stuff. I think I've conveyed that pretty well. But what's really exciting to me is that it's led to an actual prediction of something that we can put our, you know, put our finger on. We're really going to measure this. If we don't see curvature as we push these boundaries down, it all depends on what are realistic bubble curvatures, unfortunately. But I think, you know, I'll study that. I don't think it's going to be that hard to understand what's realistic for these bubbles, and I think in any case, this theory won't look so good. If there is curvature observed, it will be very exciting. And that's where I'm going to end. So the conclusions are, in the search for the big picture, it certainly generated exciting ideas. I don't think it's challenging. I don't think we've got the bottom line by any means, but there's certainly exciting ideas there. And the hope, the reason why I don't sit around moping about not knowing the fundamental physics, is we know we can do science with the universe, so we should be able to get somewhere with these questions of the whole picture of how the universe really works. It seems that there's something right about cosmic inflation. Maybe that's pushing it too hard, but there's something right. So why not try to make it work? Consider equilibrium cosmology, at the very least, offers an alternative to the extravagant, and certainly extravagant and problematic, infinities of eternal inflation. And now there's even some predictions to spice things up and help us focus on what might be actually happening in the universe. Thanks. Yeah, it's open.
Yeah, okay. Because you just drew a thing, K is positive.
Yeah, you normally. Well, usually rho K is positive for open universes. So if omega K is rho K, you're right. Yeah.
I see. You were mentioning about tunneling.
Mentioning about
tunneling?
Yes, yes.
In the quantum mechanics that we talk about tunneling of electron degrees of freedom or protons,
right,
which are very light objects.
Right.
Now, is it possible to get some feeling of the objects that are tunneling in your context?
They're fields, and they're coupled to gravity significantly, and they, I think, the... And there's actually quite a bit of tunneling of fields been studied quite a bit. And in this case, we're really talking about there's a field solution that has an interior that's where the field is up the potential, and an exterior that's sort of a region that's up the potential and a region that's down. And the seed has that behavior that it sort of comes together and then relaxes away from the up the potential state, and there's a turning point. And that turning point is then tunneled. So as in sort of standard quantum courses, you tunnel from one turning point to another.
So what would be
in this field configuration?
Value of masses of those objects. Suppose you have a correspondence with some non-related.
Well, the inf-photon masses are very, very light. So they have to be tuned to in real units.
Ten to the minus five. Plank units. That's right. So light and Plank units. Ten to the minus five are the Plank mass. I have no feeling. How much will it be? And Plank mass is ten to the nineteen GeV. So ten to the plus nineteen GeV.
So I said small, but Neil pointed out that it's small to
small
in a peculiar sense.
A small complex field is large.
Small compared to the largest mass we know.
But then the characteristic time scales will be too huge. Because if you're talking about tunneling of such a heavy object.
Yes, so the time scale is, so we're sitting in this equilibrium state, and the thermal time is of order the 14 billion years. So the smallest time scale of interest is 14 billion years. And then you have to, the dominant sort of suppression in this tunneling is actually the thermal suppression of this initial seed. And that's down by e to this huge factor, e to the minus huge factor. So it's very, very, very rare. So the e to the minus huge factor, so it's exponentially many 14 billion years. Time periods before one of these shows up. That's very, very slow.
Why is it that you get you tunnel to a configuration with lots of inflation? Why don't you tunnel and just get five?
So in the since this is driven by the seed mass, if I go higher, I actually need a smaller seed because the coherence length. So the length scale is smaller. So it's actually a smaller seed to go higher. Because the overall,
so what stops you going to zero size seed?
My constraint. So you get pushed up. So my boundary is you can't inflate more than this because you create too much entropy. And so you get pushed up against this as far as you can go. That's how this scheme works. So right. So it's less likely to tunnel here than to here. And classically, semi-classically, in the continuum picture, it's even more likely to tunnel here and here and here. Mm. But this is where, remember I said I deliberately choose where I allow the classical, the continuum theory to work or not.
Just based on the entropy?
Just based on the entropy. So that's, yeah, that's just something I pulled out of the hat. The only way I know this field theory might be breaking down is because of this entropy. So it's a non-local statement.
But is this a thermal system in which extreme fluctuations are more common than mild ones? That seems to be kind of what
I don't
you're doing.
Know.
It
no,
sits
no, it's
there
not.
And not much happens in it. Also, the whole thing produces this.
So this is the critical.
It's like ours, and then it goes back to doing
The thing that's different, and this is like, so the first paper about this kind of equilibrium state was actually by Dyson, Kleeman, and Susskind. And the thing that's, and then my paper with Sorbo, which followed, was let me try to find this there. The critical difference was that we used Guth-Fahrke, and they used Kolmogorov-Lutsch for the tunneling. And the Kolmogorov-Lutsch really is the whole universe going up. And the Guth-Fahrke looks like just a piece of the universe tunneling, mm-hmm. remaining. So this is a small fluctuation in the sense that most of the universe is sitting there in the sitter bath. It's just a tiny little piece that's tunneled, butted off. And then it joins the bath at the end. And that's the crucial difference. So in this picture, inflation is a small, the formation of inflation is a small effect, not a lot.
And I think it'd be these universes existing in parallel.
So I'm thinking that in this finite space, mm-hmm. some fraction of the degrees of freedom break off and describe a separate semi-classical picture, whereas this is still there. And then once I hit maximum entropy, they no longer can be separate. So let me take just a half a minute to. This is where some of my assumptions come in that are not from classical field, not from continuum field theory. So I'm assuming that there's some fraction of degrees of freedom describing this that are pretty well decoupled from here until we get to here. And you can argue that, so one thing is the time scale for anything down from here is 14 billion years. So that's your 14 billion years. So maybe they do couple up in one time scale. And at the very least, once you hit maximum entropy, you don't know why you'd be able to be decoupled. But those are assumptions. I don't have equations, solid equations for that. So it's guesswork. Deliberately trying to make a cosmology that holds together. It's not.
And the Goose Curry instant on is a bit questionable too in its way.
Right. So the various people have various problems with it. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I skipped over, but this year I've been working with a student, University of Chicago student, Andrew Olmsted, who will be visiting here later this summer. And we've worked out that so one of the reasons people didn't like Lufari was that it seemed that the limit of the, you could take the mass of the sea to zero and still get finite tunneling rates. So it seemed like it wasn't physically realistic in that limit, and so maybe you could argue the whole thing. So you could argue Minkowski space would tunnel randomly without any seed. So it seemed problematic in that respect. But Andrew and I have shown, we're just writing up the paper now, that, as usual, the students finished the draft, now it's waiting for me to do my part of it, is we've shown that limit was actually an artifact of a thin wall approximation that was used. And then when you consider the scalar field configurations, the sort I just described earlier, that are real scalar field configurations instead of configurations where the scalar field is constant and jumps up through a thin wall to another constant value, you can't get that limit. It's just not part of it. But there's an artificial sort of degree of freedom in the thin wall approximation where you could make it small without increasing the wall tension. So in those pictures, the wall tension was held fixed even as you made it small, but the wall tension is really coming from gradients and stuff. And the actual field configurations you look at for this tunneling are perfectly well behaved. They don't have that.
They don't have that. Singular.
Sorry?
I thought they're singular, the Guthrie instanton. It's not really.
Well, this is right. So then there's the question of the path integral description and the manifold of the instanton. It was not a manifold, it's double valued. But then there's the Fischler, Morgan, and Polchinski. Mm-hmm. Formulation in the Hamiltonian formalism that doesn't have any problems. So that I regard as a reason to not worry so much about the path integral. But if you talk to Joe Polchinski about this, and in their paper, they emphasize the center of the zero one. So there's a history of anxiety about the Guth-Farhadi process. And so so Guth and Farhadi were worried about the properties of the instanton. Polchinski and collaborators seemed to resolve that by taking a Hamiltonian point of view, but then got worried about the center goes to zero limit. And now I don't think that's a problem. People also worry about ABS-CFT arguments, whether this sort of third quantized picture of producing semi-classical space times makes sense, and there's a paper about that. But this is not ABS, and so it's, I don't think I don't know where I'm less knowledgeable about where that stands and really think about it, but I'm not convinced that it's been really solidly argued. So, but there definitely is a history of discomfort with this.
Well, we should probably finish there. So Andres is around till the end of July.
End of July, yeah.
Let's thank Andres.